Okay, let me begin. This lecture is titled Law and Economics. What I want to do is to present first in more detail the Austrian position on law, and after that the position that is taken on law in the Chicago School, and then criticize the views of the Chicago School briefly. Let me begin by describing to you what I call the problem of social order. If you have just one person living, Robinson Crusoe, then of course the problem of social order simply does not exist. Robinson Crusoe can do whatever he pleases to do, and he will not run into any type of opposition doing whatever he wants to do because he's alone. The problem of social order comes into existence only once we have more than one individual, at least two. So Friday arrives on the island. And what is the problem then that comes into existence? Consider for a moment the Garden of Eden. As you know, as you remember from your past, in the Garden of Eden, there exists no scarcity. All goods that we need or want to have exist in superabundance. And because all goods exist in superabundance, they are not scarce, it is not possible that we can have conflicts over the use of these goods. Whenever I eat a banana, I'm not taking anything away from you. There are still out there an unlimited supply of bananas. Nor do I have to be concerned about my own future supply of bananas, because whatever I eat now, there will also be a superabundant supply of bananas tomorrow and the day after, and so forth. So no conflicts arise in the Garden of Eden as far as these goods that exist in superabundance are concerned. But even in the Garden of Eden, two things are scarce and remain scarce. And because of that, conflicts over the use of these goods can arise. Now, what are the goods that are scarce even in the Garden of Eden? First, there is our own physical body. We have, each of us, only one of it. There's not an unlimited supply of bodies available for us. And because we each have only one, it is possible that conflicts over the use of our bodies arise. I might want to do something to you, and you might not be happy about what I want to do to you, or you want to do something to me, and I might not be happy about what you want to do to me. So a conflict can arise. And second, the second good that is scarce is the standing room on which our bodies rest. If I want to occupy the same space that you occupy, then necessarily a conflict arises. Or you want to occupy the same place that I occupy, then again a conflict arises. Now, the problem of social order is to develop rules that make it possible that otherwise unavoidable conflict can be avoided. And the rules that are needed, obviously, are rules that determine who has and who hasn't exclusive control over a scarce resource. And those rules are also referred to as property rules. Property is nothing else but a rule that determines this scarce resource can only be used by this person properly and not by that person. Now, what sort of rules would one adopt in the Garden of Eden after I have described what the minimal amounts of problems are that can possibly arise under such a situation? At this point, I only want to present these rules and make them intuitively acceptable. I will go into greater detail justifying these rules in a moment. Now, I think what most people would intuitively accept as rules trying to avoid possible conflict in the Garden of Eden are two rules. The first one would be each person owns exclusively, is the exclusive owner, has property in his own physical body. And the second rule that one would likely accept is every person in the Garden of Eden can move wherever he wants to move unless the place where he wants to move is already occupied by somebody else. If people would follow these two interrelated rules, then all conflicts could conceivably be avoided. Now, the difference between the Garden of Eden and the real world consists in nothing more or nothing less than in the fact that in the real world, of course, all sorts of things are scarce, not just physical bodies and standing room, but in addition, bananas and land and apples and machines, houses, whatever, all those things are scarce, and because of this, there can be a great number of possible conflicts that arise between different individuals. And the task then that we face is to formulate rules that make it possible that all conflicts can be avoided regarding all these scarce goods that are out there. And again, in the first step, I want to just simply present yourself what I consider to be the solution to the problem, and then I want to justify why that is the correct solution to the problem. I believe there would be four rules accepted. The first rule is the same one that I already described as being likely accepted in the Garden of Eden. That is, every person is a self-owner. Every person owns its physical body and determines what happens and does not happen to his body. He can do whatever he wants with his body as long as he does not interfere with the body owned by somebody else. The second rule I call the first use, first own rule. This rule regulates how we acquire property, that is, the right of exclusive control over scarce resources in previously unowned resources. So there is out there things that have not previously been owned by anyone. How do we acquire property, the exclusive right to control in those things that exist, that are nature given? And the answer is, he who makes use of a scarce resource that previously was unowned for the very first time and employs this resource in order to pursue some end, makes some purposeful use of it, thereby, by the act of being the first user of this good, becomes the owner of this good. The third rule I call the producer owns the product rule. This rule follows from the previous two. It says nothing else but that if I use my own body, of which I am the sole owner, and those things that I originally appropriated, that is, of which I was the first user, and then produce something with the help of these two means, my body and nature-given resources that have been appropriated, that is, transform nature into something that I consider to be more valuable than, rather than less valuable, then I thereby also become the owner of this product and have exclusive control over what happens or is not allowed to happen to this product. Can include people, other people, to make use of my product, or also can exclude other people from making use of my product. And finally, the fourth rule I call acquisition through voluntary exchange from an earlier owner to a later owner. Once goods are owned, then it is possible to acquire these goods through a voluntary exchange from an earlier owner to a later owner. Voluntary or contractual exchange. Now, I want to begin justifying these rules. Let me first point out that on a level of intuition, most people have very little difficulty accepting these rules, because by and large in our daily lives we follow these rules. And we consider people who break these rules as criminal offenders. Let me just point out that the first use, first own rule, for instance, you find this rule observed even on the level of small children. One child plays with a toy, and some other kid comes and wants to grab the toy, take it away from the playing child. Then the typical justification given by the first kid is, I played with that toy first. And only once I give it up, so to speak, I'm no longer interested in it, only then will you be entitled to play with the same toy. Even in the animal kingdom, you see this rule observed. Now, but intuition is one thing and proof is another. So now a step more rigorous. And I want to use, so to speak, two approaches to defend these rules. The first one is by simply assuming the opposite and showing that by assuming opposite rules, different rules, we run into fundamental difficulties. What are conceivable alternatives to the first rule of self-ownership? No, the first conceivable alternative would be the alternative of having what we call a system of slavery. I own you, but you don't own me. I am the owner of your body, but you are not the owner of my body. What is the problem with this alternative? Now, the answer is that this alternative does not satisfy what has been called by philosophers the universalization criterion. Or, to use a different formulation, it does not satisfy what we have learned to be the golden rule of ethics. You know what the golden rule is? The golden rule says, don't do unto other things that you don't want to have done unto yourself. And the idea of universalization means nothing else. It says any rule that aspires to be an ethical rule must be one that is equally applicable to all individuals. There should not be a set of rules that applies to one group of people and another set of rules that applies to a different set of rules. There should not be a set of rules that applies only to men, but not to women. And there should not be a set of rules that applies whatever to Eskimos, but not to Zulus. And it is perfectly clear that this alternative of slavery does not pass the universalization criterion. There are different classes of individuals according to this alternative. What is the second alternative? The second alternative is the alternative of universal communism. That would be the following rule. Each person owns an equal part of everyone else. I own a 50th of you, and you own a 50th of me. You realize that this rule does pass the universalization test, because in this case, the same rule would apply to every single individual. However, the flaws with this alternative are even more dramatic than the flaws of the first alternative that I presented. The first alternative could at least be practiced. As a matter of fact, we know that slavery existed. The second alternative, however, even though it does pass a universalization criterion, cannot truly be implemented at all. It is, so to speak, a deadly rule. Why? Now, if I only own a 50th of my own body, then it should be perfectly clear that I'm not permitted to do anything with my body, let's say move it from here to here, without having the consent of all the other 49 owners of my body. But then ask yourself, can these other 49 members give their consent? That is, can they say, yes, you may move from this place to that place? And the answer is, no, they cannot even give their consent. Because what is required in order to give your consent? In order to give your consent, you must say, yes, you may do this. But what is necessary for you to say, yes, you can do this, is you have to make use, for instance, of your brain and your vocal cords and so forth. But you are not the exclusive owner of your brains and your vocal cord, because 49 other people also have a claim to your vocal cords and to your brain. So in other words, the second alternative, has simply absurd consequences. We cannot implement this. We would all die out instantly if we were to follow this rule, because nobody can do anything ever. Okay. If we look at the second rule, and try to find the alternative there, I will be a little bit briefer here. We see again, one alternative would be the second person, or the third, or the fourth person is the owner of something, and not the first. Now you immediately realize what the implications of this are. They also are absurd implications. Then nobody could ever be the first. That is, we always would have to wait for the second. But the second also cannot do anything with anything, because by me not doing anything to begin with, the second one would be the first. And then he would have to wait for the third. So again, the implication here would be nobody can ever do anything with anything. And the other alternative would be instead of saying the first one is the owner of the resources that he first put to use, all of us are the owner of these of these resources. But you realize immediately why this is not a correct solution to our problem either. Remember, what we want to solve when it comes to the social problem is we want to formulate rules that help us avoid otherwise unavoidable conflicts. But if a multitude of people are the owners of this good, then conflicts are made necessary. We don't avoid them if they don't happen to agree, as if by accident, on what should or should not be done with these resources. If they disagree what should be done, then we automatically have a conflict, and it was precisely the purpose of formulating rules that these otherwise unavoidable conflicts can be avoided. So what we end up with then is these rules, and of these rules we can say they fulfill the requirements that I mentioned. On the one hand, they are universalizable. They are the same rules applying to every single individual. They are not different rules applying to different classes of individuals. And secondly, if we act according to these rules, we can indeed act independently of others and survive, which obviously is necessary for any human ethic. Now, a second approach trying to justify these rules. And the second approach first tries to point out another necessary requirement for the need of law or ethics to arise. The first one I already pointed out, it is the existence of scarcity. Otherwise, we don't need rules. The second requirement can be recognized by presenting you with the following situation. Let's say I have a conflict with a bear. The bear is intent upon eating me up or pushing me aside. And can I then say to the bear, you know, this is not right. Didn't you recognize that I was already standing at this place? That makes obviously no sense. Here the conflict is between two entities, one of which can claim rationality, and I will have to say a little bit more about what rationality means in a moment, and the other entity is not a rational entity. I can also have a conflict with a mosquito who sits on my arm and tries to bite me. Do I have a moral conflict at hand? And the answer is no, we don't have a moral conflict at hand. This is just a technical conflict. We just have to learn how to just handle mosquitoes and bears, just as we have to learn how to deal with nature, that a brick doesn't fall onto my head. In the mosquito case, it is easy how we handle this type of problem. With bears, it is a little bit more difficult, but we have also learned how to handle this problem. So there we have a technical problem. In order for us to have a problem that we consider to be a moral or ethical or legal problem, it is necessary that both entities that are involved in the conflict at hand, that both entities are rational. And rationality expresses itself in the form of the ability of engaging in argument, engaging in discussion, engaging in some propositional exchange, in a verbal dispute. And you realize that this statement that I just made is undeniably true, because you cannot argue that you cannot argue. Because of this, it has also sometimes been referred to as the a priori of communication, or the a priori of argumentation. Similar to the axiom of action, which cannot be, so to speak, disputed by anyone, because the disputing of it would itself be an action. We cannot dispute this axiom of argumentation, because in order to dispute it, we would ourselves have to engage in argumentation also. Only in argumentation, in propositional exchanges, do we ever make truth claims. That is, do we ever aspire to say something that is true or valid and so forth? And whether there exists an ethic or none at all, and which one it is, all of this can only be clarified in the course of an argumentation. Okay. Nobody can deny this without running into a contradiction, because a denial itself would have to be made in the form of a proposition. Now, the next step in this second approach to justify these rules is to recognize that there are certain presuppositions involved whenever we argue with each other, whenever we discuss something. That certain necessary requirements that must be fulfilled in order to make it possible that we argue with each other. And then it is obviously impossible to ask for a further justification of these presuppositions that are necessary in order to engage in argumentation. That is, we cannot ask, is it justified to make use of these presuppositions if these presuppositions themselves are necessary in order to begin an argumentation? Now, what are these presuppositions? We recognize them by recognizing first that arguing is not just free-floating sounds encountering each other in mid-air. Arguing presupposes an arguing entity. As a matter of fact, two arguing entities. And recognizing this means to recognize that in order to argue, the proponent and the opponent in an argument must both have exclusive control over their body, or at least parts of their body. That is, I must be the exclusive owner of my brain and vocal cords and so forth in order to say certain things, suggest certain things, claim certain things. And in addressing these things to you, and allowing you to respond to it, you must be the exclusive owner of certain body parts or your entire body also. That is, we could not say, without contradicting ourselves, we are not entitled to make use of our own physical bodies. We are not entitled to make use of, have exclusive control over our vocal cords and brains. If we would say this, then we would be involved in what is called a performative contradiction. That is, the content of our statement is contradicted by the very fact of making exclusive use of these body parts. When it comes to original appropriation of other things, how do we justify this? Now, again, by what might be called an argumentum a contrario. If we would not have the right to acquire anything except our own physical bodies, then we would all be dead. And the question of ethics would no longer exist. But, as I said, the purpose of ethical rules is, of course, to make living, make the existence of humans on Earth possible. So it must be possible that property in other things besides our physical body can be acquired. And now there exist basically only two types in which this acquisition can take place. Either in the form that I described by tying a certain individual through its action to some specific resource. I made first use of certain things and thereby become the owner. Or I declare verbally that I am the owner of such and such without having done anything to these resources. This is, incidentally, the way that governments acquire their property. They land at some place and then they say, as far as the eye can see, I claim this is all mine. That is, they do not homestead or originally appropriate these things. They simply declare such and such is mine. Now, what is wrong with the idea of property can be acquired by means of declaration? Now, what is wrong with this is again no solution to the problem at hand, namely to formulate a rule that helps us avoid conflicts. Because if you can acquire property by declaration, then you can have, of course, incompatible declarations made by different individuals. So I land at the same place and say, as far as the eye can see, it's all mine. And you just say the same. And the third person says also the same. So who then is the real owner? And the answer is, we have no answer to this question. So this is, even on technical grounds, not a sufficient solution. Conflict will be unavoidable again if that were the principle of property acquisition. In order to avoid it, we must tie specific individuals to specific resources at specific points in time. So we are ending up again with the rule of first come, first serve, or first use, first own. Now a few misconceptions and a clarification of these misconceptions that sometimes arise in connection with these rules. The first clarification I want to offer is that property exists only in physical things. That one cannot have property rights in the value of things. Let me just explain that by taking a simple example. Let's say I'm in the labor market looking for a job. And then a second person comes around competing against me for this job. What does the second person do as far as the value that I have in the labor market is concerned? It lowers my value in the labor market. I might get a higher wage if this person would disappear from Earth, so to speak. If the appearance of the second individual lowering my value in the labor market, if this appearance of a second person is an aggression against me, because it lowered the value, then I must be entitled, of course, to retaliate. That is, to make that guy disappear from Earth. And the other person, of course, would have the same right vis-a-vis me. That is, we would be back at having permanent conflicts with each other. So this is not a violation of property rights that a second person comes along and lowers the value that I have as long as he does not physically attack me. I mean, if he would chop off my arm or something like this and thereby lower the value that I have in the market, that would be something different. But if he doesn't do anything to my body, just simply appears, then that would be perfectly all right. To take another example, I open a store right next door from you and sell the same sort of goods. Now that might reduce your business. Does this constitute an aggression? And the answer is, no, it doesn't constitute an aggression as long as I do not smash your goods that you have in the store. As soon as I would smash the goods in your store, then, of course, it does constitute an aggression. But not as long as that does not occur and I only lower the value of your property. So aggression is always a physical harm that occurs to the property of someone else, not a reduction in the value that is represented by the property of someone else. The second clarification as far as these rules are concerned is that, yes, I am allowed to do with my property whatever I want, except I may not, by doing to my property whatever I want, cause physical damage to the property of others. And what we have to keep in mind when it comes to possible conflicts that arise is in the acquisition of property, there's always a time dimension involved. And in order to decide who is right and who is wrong in a conflict, we must take this time dimension into consideration. Consider this. I settle this piece of land and I have no neighbor, no one around. And then I erect a factory and the factory sends out smoke and the smoke lands on the territory next to me, which is uninhabited. And now somebody else comes along and settles right next to me. And he complains about the smoke that comes out of my property. Is his complaint justified? Do I have to compensate this person? Do I have to stop sending out smoke if he demands me to do so? And the answer is no, because my right was acquired earlier. I have acquired an easement of sending out smoke from my property. This second person acquired already dirty property. And he still considered it to be an improvement of his own position, otherwise he simply would not have acquired it. So in this case, I don't need to compensate him. On the other hand, if the situation were different, here I'm settled, and now somebody else comes later on, and he sends out smoke. In that case, I would say, yes, I acquired clean property, and now the second one makes my property dirty, which it was not before. In this case, I could stop the second person and demand compensation, or you can no longer do what you are currently doing. Now, briefly, the economics of these four rules. That is an explanation of why, as long and to the extent that we do follow these rules, this will lead by and large to the production of the greatest economic wealth. And again, that can be seen simply by considering the alternative to these rules. Slavery, as we know, is an inefficient way of producing. The slave has simply no incentive to be productive. The slave's incentive is to get away with as little work as possible, because after all, he is not the owner of the products and services that he produces. Free labor, that is, people owning themselves, is more productive than slavery. Consider the alternatives to rule number two. As I said, if the second or third or fourth person would be considered to be the owner rather than the first, even apart from the absurd consequences, you can immediately see what the consequence of this were. If the first one is no longer considered to be the exclusive owner of a resource that he first put to use, then the incentive to be the first is obviously reduced. Let's say I know there's some major gold findings in Siberia. And there is a major effort involved in schlepping myself out to Siberia. If I know that I will be regarded as the owner of the gold mine, then I might go. If I know, on the other hand, no, regardless of the fact that I'm the first one there, I'm not considered to be the owner of it, will I schlep out to Siberia then? And the answer is not very likely. What is the consequence of this? The consequence of this is that the discovery of valuable resources that have not been used up until this point is, of course, reduced. And standard of living drops because of this. The same is obviously true if the rule would be, we recognize a certain amount of, recognize you as a part owner of those things that you first appropriated, but other parts are owned by others. Again, my incentive then would clearly be reduced, depending, of course, on what proportion of the property would be owned by others who have not gone through this strenuous effort of going out there and discovering certain valuable resources that have not been used up until now. So clearly a less productive way of organizing society than this rule constitutes. The same is true for producer owns the product. The alternative would be some non-producer owns the product. So how productive will people be under that alternative scenario? The non-producer of the product is regarded as the owner of the product. Now then, obviously, there's very little incentive for anyone to produce anything because he knows he will not be able to reap the fruits of his own labor. They will be reaped by somebody else. And the same would be true if we just take a less drastic rule. The producer owns part of the product that he produces, but whatever 50%, 60%, 70%, you immediately recognize this is what states do when they impose taxes. Half of your product you have to hand over to someone else, or three quarters of it you have to hand over to someone else, or maybe only 1% you have to hand over to someone else. Obviously, depending on the degree of expropriation that takes place here, you have a larger or a smaller disincentive to be a productive individual. But no matter how small it is, it will be a disincentive as compared to a situation where the producer is regarded as the sole owner of whatever he has produced. And of course, if we look at the last rule, if you could acquire property not through voluntary exchanges, but in any way you wish, by hitting people on the head or something like this. And if everyone could do that, acquire whatever they want to acquire by violent means, then you can imagine that very soon there will be no property that can be robbed anymore in this fashion, because nobody has any incentive to bring property into existence knowing that his possession of his property is constantly in danger. We can also say that these four rules, in a certain interpretation, fulfill the so-called Pareto criterion. Now, Pareto was of the opinion that utility is ordinal, cannot be measured. And if utility is ordinal, then we can only speak of an improvement of social welfare, that is, the welfare of more than one individual, if the following condition is fulfilled. The way he formulated it is, there must be at least two individuals who benefit from or there must be at least one individual who increases his welfare, and no individual whose welfare is decreased. Then we can speak of an increase in social welfare. If there is an increase in the welfare takes place on the part of one person and a decrease in the welfare that takes place in the welfare of another person, then you cannot say anything about social welfare because the increases and the decreases cannot be compared given that utility is ordinal, that we have no numbers. We can only say there are winners and there are losers, but we cannot say how great the wins of the winner are and the losses of the loser are. But we can then say social welfare did not increase. Social welfare only increases if one guy is better off, at least one guy, and no one else is worse off. Now, these rules, self-ownership, each person being self-owner, is clearly fulfilling this criterion as compared with the alternative of slavery. This rule, the first appropriator of some previously unowned good, must obviously be better off than the otherwise would be, otherwise he would not have done what he did. And as for the rest of the world, we can say, by doing this, being the first one to put something to use, nobody has taken anything away from anybody else. Everybody else was entitled to homestead, originally appropriate the same goods, but they did other things, showed, demonstrated that they prefer to do other things rather than appropriate these things. So nothing was taken away from them. A producer increases his own well-being by being a producer. He doesn't take anything away from others. Other people still own exactly the same goods that they owned before. Accordingly, we can say this also is a Pareto superior move. And of course, when it comes to voluntary exchanges, the two voluntary exchange partners must both gain from the exchange, as you have heard repeatedly, otherwise they wouldn't do it. Two individuals are better off, and nothing happens to the supply of goods available to others. They all still have the same amount of goods available that they had before. That is, no one is made worse off, two individuals gain. This is also a Pareto superior move. Now I want to come to the Chicago School. Now let me emphasize that this view that I presented up until this point, which is what the Austrians adopt, is also by and large the classical view about property and property rights. You can find that going back hundreds, even thousands of years, that by and large these sorts of rules were considered to be the basic rules underlying peaceful social cooperation. Not all people who accepted these rules were willing to be completely consistent in the application of the rules. That comes into play in particular when the question arises, is a state justified? Is a government justified? And people who just say that it is then get involved typically in some sort of inconsistencies. But on a very elementary level, most people accept these rules as a matter of fact. What is the Chicago alternative? And what I have in mind when I talk about the Chicago alternative is the alternative as represented in particular by Ronald Coase and by Richard Posner. These alternative was first developed in that famous article on social cost by Ronald Coase, which is the most quoted, most cited article in all of economic literature today. Coase alternative can be explained in the following way. He gives us an example. There is a farmer and there's a railroad, and the railroad emits sparks, and the sparks do damage to the crop of the adjacent farmer. And now the question is, who is right and who is wrong in this ensuing conflict between these two agents, the farmer and the railroad owner? The classical view, the Austrian view, would be We have to find out who was there first. If the farmer was there first and then the railroad was established, then we would say the farmer is now entitled to stop the railroad from emitting sparks or ask for compensation and so forth. On the other hand, if the railroad was there first emitting sparks and then the farmer established himself as the immediate neighbor of the railroad, then we would say the railroad can continue emitting sparks because the farmer only acquired property that was already damaged by this sort of pollution of sparks. Okay. That's the classic solution to this problem. But this is not the solution that Coase proposes. What Coase says is this, and I want to quote him on this. Coase claims it is wrong to think of the farmer and the railroad as either right or wrong, as liable or not liable, as aggressor or victim. What he says is this, direct quote, "The question is commonly thought of as one in which A inflicts harm on B, and what has to be decided is, how should we restrain A? But this is wrong. We are dealing with a problem of reciprocal nature. To avoid the harm to B would be to inflict harm on A. The real question that has to be decided is, should A be allowed to harm B, or should B be allowed to harm A? The problem is to avoid the more serious harm." Now, I want to use an analogy, a drastic analogy, in order to show you the perverse consequences of this view of how to deal with conflicts. And I'm using the same sort of wording that Coase uses in this example. We are looking at a case where A is raping B. Okay. Now, in this case, according to Coase, we would not automatically say that A is an aggressor, and A is supposed to be restrained. No, using his words, we are dealing with a problem of reciprocal nature. In preventing A from raping B, harm is inflicted on A, because A is no longer allowed to rape, and that is, of course, a harm done to him. So in preventing A from raping B, harm is inflicted on A because he can no longer rape freely. The real question is, should A be allowed to rape B, or should B be allowed to prohibit A from raping him? The problem is to avoid the more serious harm. Okay. Now, just imagine that B is a professional prostitute or something like this. And then people might say, no, yeah, the harm that occurs to her is relatively moderate because she is, after all, in the trade. Imagine that A is a person who was locked away for 20 years and had no access to women in 20 years and is really, really starved in this regard. Then the answer is, yeah, in this case, by preventing A from raping B, we might actually inflict greater harm on A than we inflict on B. So A should be permitted to go ahead, and B should just shut up. So you immediately recognize the perverse consequences of this view. The view boils down basically to the following, and Posner has formulated that quite clearly. He says, in his book on the economics of justice, he says at one point, just is what maximizes wealth, and unjust is then what does not maximize wealth. I'll give you an example also taken directly from Posner that illustrates what he thinks of justice and injustice. The example is this. Suppose there is a polluting factory which lowers residential property values in an area by $2 million. But that it would cost the factory $3 million to relocate. On the basis of this, the factory prevails. Why? Because the reduction in value caused by the factory is only $2 million, but the factory produces actually something that is worth $3 million. Relocation costs $3 million. So in this case, wealth would be reduced if we would force the factory to relocate. But now reverse the numbers. That is, property values in an area fall by $3 million, and the relocation costs are $2 million. So in this case, the company would be forced to relocate. So this, again, being illustration of the idea, what maximizes wealth is just, what does not maximize wealth is unjust. Now, let me just point out a few perverse consequences of this view. First, an example that you find in Posner himself. He considers the question, what would have happened if Henry Ford, instead of becoming the industrialist that we know him to have become, would have decided to become a Trappist monk, that is, withdraw from society. Now, he said, we may be reasonably confident that the American people would be poorer if Henry Ford had decided to become a Trappist monk rather than an automobile manufacturer. Now, what follows from this? If Henry Ford had decided to become a Trappist monk, he would have lowered the wealth in society. Lowering the wealth in society is an unjust act. What follows from that? What follows from that would be that we could enslave Ford and put him into the Ford factory and just tell him, hey, keep on being the Ford that you were supposed to be instead of just being a Trappist monk. That is, you don't even own your own physical body anymore in this regard. You can be enslaved. Or another example that shows the perversity of these people. Similarly, if there is a taste for pure solitude, that is, for seclusion unrelated to social interaction, it is a selfish emotion. Solitary activity benefits only the actor. Work, on the other hand, confers benefits on others. There is thus a sense in which the person who works is unselfish, while the individual who retires from the world reduces his contribution to the wealth of other people in society. So if you retire and stop working, this again is an unselfish act. That is, no old person should ever be permitted to just retire from work life. If they do want to do this, we must enslave them and force them to continue working because only that is just. And retiring is a selfish act that must be in some way punished. Last remark. Does this rule of trying to maximize wealth indeed do what it says it will do, that is, maximize wealth? And I want to advance the argument, no, it doesn't. If this rule is implemented, property rights should be assigned in such a way that wealth is at all times maximized. That means nothing else but that property rights are no longer secure. Property can be taken away from you if somebody else promises to make more efficient use of it than you yourself do. Now, if property rights are no longer safe but can be reassigned depending on the assessment of who will make better use of certain things, then, of course, unsecure property rights will lead to overall less productive individuals. People will no longer be as productive knowing that at any point in time their property can be taken away from them, given that there is somebody who might make better use of it than they themselves do. Imagine this. I could say, for instance, that he is a bum. He has a wallet with $500 in his pocket, and all he does is just go out to the bodega and drink that money away. Whereas I would wisely invest these $500. So in that case, if I rob him of his wallet, the courts would say that is perfectly justified because Hopper promises to increase the wealth, whereas this guy, by going to the bodega and drinking his money away, will decrease wealth. He is not the owner, I'm the owner. And then the next day it might happen that me having stolen the $500 from him, somebody else comes and says, I have even far better idea what to do with the $500 in Hopper had. And then the property rights are reassigned to that person. Will a situation such as this lead to productive individuals? The answer seems to be clear as daylight. That will not increase social wealth. It will actually decrease social wealth. It is precisely the stability of property rights, even if they sometimes lead to a situation where a person does not make the best possible use of it, that in the long run, by and large, will lead to the greatest production of wealth. Let me end by making this note. In these recent Supreme Court decisions about takings, you notice that the Supreme Court allowed taking from one private property owner and giving it to another one. When? Under what circumstances? If you increase the tax revenue by taking it from one person and giving it to another. This is an outflow, an outgrowth of Chicago law and economics thinking. The Chicago law and economics people are quite influential in the legal profession. Mr. Posner is a very high-ranking judge in the United States. And this entire philosophy you can find in these Supreme Court decisions to take your property away because you promise to pay less taxes on your property than somebody else will. And this somebody else, because he promises to pay higher taxes than you do, he is then assigned the property and is taken away from you. So I think the Chicago law and economics program should be also called the Chicago unjustice and economics program. Thank you very much.